This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Good evening and welcome to Northcote Town Hall. I'm Michael Williams. I'm the director of the Wheeler Centre, and I'm thrilled to see so many of you out here tonight for this evening's very special guest. It is easy, I think, for us as Australians to occasionally get smug and complacent about what a train wreck US politics is at the moment. But it is salient to remember that for all the things that are causing grief in the US at the moment, they have a much more sophisticated relationship to their own tortured history than we do here in Australia. And the fact that a book like The Underground Railroad can get such popular and critical acclaim is something that we should think about here in Australia. When was the last time a book that dealt properly with our difficult past and the ways in which Australian history is not always something to be proud of got that kind of widespread appeal? I would suggest that we should be out there reading Ali Cobby Eckerman, or we should be reading Kim Scott, we should be reading Bruce Pascoe and all these amazing Indigenous writers to remember that this event, this city, this society that we live in is on Indigenous land. Tonight's event is on the land of the Wurundjeri people. I pay my respects to them and other people of the Kulin Nation, their elders past and present, and members of any other communities that are with us tonight. Being a fan of Colson Whitehead's work is a challenge, because basically he spent his whole career teaching you not to get complacent and think you know what's going to come next. Sure. You know, so you enjoy that work of memoir? Well, here, have this zombie book. You enjoyed that zombie book? Here, have this book about poker. Every time you think he'll zig, he zags, and he does it with aplomb and wit and incredible audacity. He is one of my favourite writers, and it is thrilling to see his most recent book, The Underground Railroad, be received the way it has been. It is the first novel, as far as we can tell, been doing a bit of fact-checking, since The Shipping News, to win both the National Book Award for Fiction and the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. It was on, it was Oprah's pick, it was on Barack Obama's summer reading list, it's been shortlisted for the Arthur C. Clarke Award for Science Fiction Literature. From every angle, this is a masterpiece and one that people are telling you should read. Please welcome Colson Whitehead.
Thanks.
Are you a contrarian? Do you deliberately, do you get bored with the things you've written about and need to go in a different
direction? I do. I mean, I'm definitely done with a topic when I've written about it. And so my first book was about elevators and elevator inspectors. And the protagonist was very repressed. And so my book after that was very expansive, had a lot of different voices. And I'm just trying not to repeat myself. You know, I figure if I can do something, why do it again? But I think in the last couple of books, it's become very, a bit more perverse, because it's gone from autobiographical coming-of-age story to zombies to poker, World Series of Poker, to slavery in America. So it seems like I'm being willfully contrarian. But it's really just, I'm just trying not to do the same thing. Like a short book, long book, funny book, more depressing book. It seems to make sense to me.
Are there through lines? Like, would we be stupid to think that just because you're choosing different forms and different genres, you're not, maybe it's not elevators, but going back to that first book, The Intuitionist, there's a lot of stuff in there that runs as a thread all the way through your work.
I guess I would say, yeah, I would say race, pop culture, the city, and then if I could get some jokes in, I'm always happy. There are very few jokes in the new book. Maybe people don't like my sense of humor, and that's why people are digging it. I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, you set yourself a challenge being someone who likes jokes doing a big book about slavery. That's yes. Definitely a hard way.
Yeah, constraints are good.
Yeah. Those threads through it, I was struck by a line. I was rereading Sag Harbor, which I adore, the other day, and there's a line in there where the protagonist says, in growing up in the early 80s, there were famous black people I'd never heard of, but it was too late to ask who they were, because I was old enough by some secret measure that it was a disgrace that I didn't know who they were. These people who had struggled and suffered for every last comfort I enjoyed. That idea about growing up with a weight of history that you had a responsibility to know, is that an autobiographical line?
Well, I think a bit. You know, people are always dropping names like Paul Robeson or Du Bois, and it's like, who was that? Like, I'm afraid I don't actually know who that is. And back then, you couldn't just Google it secretly in the bathroom. Like, nowadays, you're at a party of like, I sort of recognize that person, and then you go to a bathroom and like, you know, figure out where you met them before. In the old days, you couldn't do that. And you just had to suffer in silence and be ashamed that you weren't aware of all these famous black figures.
Luckily, you have a president who's not aware of those famous black figures.
Yes, it makes it, you know, I guess nowadays, ignorance, you know, you have a lot of company.
And, yeah. Furtive Googling in the bathroom, happening in the White House. Like, who is this?
Yes. Middle East, where are we?
It's very confusing and exhausting, I understand. So as someone who an interest in race permeates your work, doing a book about slavery must feel, to a certain extent, like a kind of culmination of lots of that work.
Well, I think, you know, in some ways it's kind of a cliche to be a black writer and write about slavery. Like, it's always there. And, you know, when I was younger and very self-conscious, it seemed like that, you know, writing a book about southern misery was kind of a cliche.
You've actually pilloried in your own work.
Yeah. But then, you know, since I am moving around and then in different genres, it's just always sitting there. And, you know, writing about poker or zombies, in the back there's always just, why aren't you writing about America and history? And so I always have a few ideas floating around, and then hopefully at the right time I'll figure out when to tackle this or that subject.
And this was an idea you had floating around 16, 17 years ago.
Yeah, I was sitting on my couch and came across a reference to the Underground Railroad, and I remembered how when I was a kid, when I first heard those two words, I envisioned a literal subway that would take slaves to freedom. And it just seemed like that was a crazy idea for a book. Why not do it? And there's not much of a story there, so I added that complicating idea that each state that Cora goes through is a different state of American possibility, like Gulliver's Travels. And it just seemed like back then, I couldn't pull it off. I didn't think I was a good enough writer. I would have screwed it up maybe if I was older and wiser and like saw more of the world, stabbed a hobo with a penknife, or you know, just had some adventures, I could bring that to the work. And so each time I finished a book, I'd go back to the idea and think, am I ready? And it wasn't until about a few years ago that I thought, finally now.
How do you think you would have got it wrong back then? And what do you think naivety would have done to the story that would have ruined it?
Well, I think there are a few things. I think Sag Harbor, which you mentioned, is a very digressive novel, and John Henry Days are both has an encyclopedic kind of structure. And with this, I felt I had done that, and so it's very reined in and much more direct than some of my earlier books. My previous book before this one was a humor book about the World Series of Poker, so I got all the jokes out of my system. And then for many years, the different states were like Gulliver's Travels, totally different worlds, and so it was very much more science fiction-y. And South Carolina, if you read the book, took place in the future, and the eugenics experiments were very high-tech. And so if I'd written it 5 or 10 years ago, a lot of the fantasy would have been much more broad. And then when I was thinking about writing it, I went back to 100 Years of Solitude, which was a very, you know, very big book for me when I was a teenager. And it just seemed that kind of magic realism where you're presenting reality and fantasy with a straight face would be a good voice for the book in terms of the absurd thing that happens. And then also in slave narratives, you know, former slaves would describe the brutality of the plantation without adorning it dramatically. And so I saw my mother beaten to death, and the next day I started in the fields. And it's just, you know, the worst thing imaginable is presented in this matter-of-fact voice. So if I'd written it earlier, I wouldn't have had that sort of formula. I think that works for the book.
The scale of the brutality and the degradation in the stories, did that make you nervous in approaching it? Did it feel like territory that you had to handle differently, more carefully?
Well, I think that's part of why I put it off for so many years. I didn't want to do the research, do such a deep dive into history. So the second part of the question, which
It was just about handling it with more delicacy, perhaps. What responsibility did you feel to the historical record, for example?
A few things. I mean, I think once you make the book, once you have this fantastic armature for the book, it's not going to be a straight historical novel. In reading and going back to the history of slavery as a grown-up, it seemed I had a duty to my own ancestors to get it right before I start playing with things. And so before we get to the fantasy part, I wanted to have a realistic, which means a very brutal depiction of slavery, just to honor them. Like, I'm not sure where my great-great-grandfathers and great-great-grandmothers lived and died. Was it Alabama, Florida, what kind of plantation? Obviously, some of my ancestors survived because I'm here, but they're nameless. I don't know where they lived and died. And so to honor them and other people who went through it, before I started fooling around with history, I wanted to get it right. People talk about the burden of representation, and for me, I generally don't feel that, but I did feel that sense of duty with this thing.
So for those who haven't had a chance to read the book, Cora is on a plantation in Georgia at the beginning, and as you say, it is particularly brutal, particularly graphic. It's delivered as a kind of realist account before she gets out of there. Can you explain it a little?
Sure. She's on a plantation in Georgia, a cotton plantation. She's 16 or 17. You're being sold off, moved around, and so she doesn't know how old she is. You know, slave masters didn't keep track of their property in the same way you might have a vacuum cleaner and might know vaguely when you bought it. You wouldn't know the exact birthday of your vacuum cleaner. And so her mother's run off. She's alone. And someone, a new slave to a plantation who's been raised in the North, has links to the Underground Railroad. And after things get complicated, she decides to go with them and take this great leap to go north.
And it's at that point that the book pivots, as you say. So you take this kind of realist basis, and then you have this fabulist overlay. And there's this incredible image when they first come out of the Underground Railroad for the first time and clasp eyes on a skyscraper, which is this amazing message to the reader that anything's possible here.
Yeah, for me, I was very excited when I got to that part because I had this idea in my back of my head for so many years. And a lot of the fun part is in playing with history. And definitely, I think always the first 60 pages or 100 pages can be a drag sometimes because you're introducing the characters and you're doing all this stuff to set the rules of the world. And for me, getting to the skyscraper, I knew I could just let it rip after, establishing everything. So for me, as a writer, it's a very liberating moment. And then it is a sign for the reader that we're not sticking to the facts anymore.
And so then you're liberated. You telescope time and space, and you take in elements from 19th century, 20th century that suit the story that you're telling.
Yeah, well, I mean, for example, in North Carolina, it's a white supremacist state, and Cora is hiding in an attic, and that's based on a famous slave narrative by Harriet Jacobs, who supposedly spent 7 years in an attic before she could get passage out of North Carolina. And you think hiding in an attic, Anne Frank, and so I bring in some of the language and imagery of Nazi Germany, and I can contrast the oppression of blacks in America with the oppression of Jews in Germany. A lot of the Nazi scientific eugenics language comes from 19th century American scientists, and so all the assholes in 19th century and 20th century are reading the same stuff and using the same bunk science for their theories. So how can I, by moving things around, enlarge the conversation to make it not just a story of someone escaping north, but about America and the world?
And the great thing is the 21st century is providing assholes to make it keep relevant.
Well, yes. I mean, if you have a white nationalist in the White House who's drawing from the same sort of ideas that defined American political thought in the 18th and 19th centuries, yes, there's a through line.
So how immersed were you in traditional slave narrative and that the telling of that story before you wrote this? Because there's an amazing tradition of it and many extraordinary examples. Did you read up a lot? Was that something kind of in deep background that was just culturally unique?
It was deep background. I mean, I think, it seems like I did a lot of research for the book. I didn't do as much as you'd think. You know, there are two sort of big histories of the railroad, which were very useful. But of course, I don't really stick to what happened. And so they gave me a general idea of how it actually worked. And then as a fiction writer, reading slave narratives gives me nouns and adjectives and verbs that hopefully make it sound realistic. But I first read slave narratives in college. I first came across a book about the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, which is in the book, in college. And I'm glad that I've been lugging these books around for 30 years and I finally got to use them. I think even in my 20s, I was like, I'll write a book, I'll write about this one day. And so it's really just drawing different things I've been interested in over the decades. And because I can do 3 pages here on this subject and 3 pages there and put them in conversation with each other, I really am just drawing in on so many different things that have piqued my interest over the years.
Did that create its own pressure, though? I mean, it strikes me that the real braveness of this book is by not delivering it as a straight history, by taking the history as a jumping-off point. There's a danger that it could wind up feeling ahistorical, and actually it goes the other way. But were you nervous about that? Were you nervous about pushing the envelope too far?
Well, I think I felt I had nailed a realistic plantation experience in the first part, so I felt like my debt had been paid, so I could do whatever.
That's totally how it works.
And then it was really liberating. I think the narrative voice that I hit upon very early allowed me to be close with the characters, but also take back and be a little bit more have the narrator be analyzing what's going on. And then I was being more concise than usual than I am in my books. And so that was a constraint that really sort of helped me. I think for me, the skyscraper scene was important. And also when I got to the Museum of Living History, when Cora is a sort of living, an actor in a diorama of different scenes of history. And it was 2 pages. Then I was like, old Colson would have made this 10 pages and had like the curator and who built everything. But new Colson is happy with 2 pages. And so the compression of the voice, I think, was a really good tool for keeping me in check and also allowing me to just jump around.
I don't want to digress, but can we then assume that new Colson for the next book will be like 40 pages for the equivalent passage?
I'm getting there. You know, I'm reading a lot of novellas now. My attention span because of like the news is totally shot. So I'm like 200 pages. That's like a real, you know, so this book is 300, not going to 2. So maybe 40, yeah, 2 books from now.
Mix it up a little bit. The museum is really crucial as a passage because it is one of the bits where you really get to play out that historical range stuff. You give Cora access to ideas and things that wouldn't necessarily fit within the narrative of the book. Was that an early idea?
Yeah, well, she is an object. She's a slave, piece of property, and part of her journey is going north and also a journey into personhood and discovering who she is, different ideas of freedom. And so how do you get someone who's uneducated educated? And she learns how to read. And also the dioramas in the museum, there's like a typical African village, Middle Passage, typical Dana plantation, and she's not educated, but she knows that the African village isn't right. She knows that the Middle Passage wasn't as carefree as it's depicted. She knows that the plantation scene isn't accurate. And so how can I find different arenas where she can gain agency? And maybe she hasn't read a history of Africa and slavery, but she knows something right and can be more of an active player. So I'm always like trying to find different, I guess I call them arenas for some reason, where she can come into personhood, and that was an important scene for me.
It's, and I've heard you refer to the kind of structure of the book as essentially rebooting every 60 pages. And that also seems to be a liberating thing from a narrative perspective. But it doesn't come at the expense of growth for Cora. Like, there's a very palpable sense of her journey, to use an overused word. But
it's okay. Technically correct. What are you going to say? Yeah.
That rebooting, though, how much... did New Colson have to work hard not to really kind of untether and play in each
of
these movies?
Well, I find that, you know, the structural constraints of each book very interesting. So Sag Harbor is about growing up in the 80s, and it is, each chapter is self-contained. They're not really short stories because they rely on information from before. But I was thinking, how can I structure a novel like a book of short stories? And so the constraints of this book were very interesting and a neat challenge.
Hmm. Sag Harbor, if you haven't read it, is seriously funny as well. It's like, I adore it. It's a wonderful book. Yeah. I wasn't saying if you haven't read it. I know you've read it. That was for them. I hope you've read it. You should. Yeah. It's great. I know that in the early conception for this book, your protagonist was going to be male. How important was the shift to a female slave narrative? How distinct does that make the story?
Well, I talked about switching genres just because I'm sick of what I did before, and so that was in it. I had a string of three very meditative male narrators, and so, you know, back of my head is like, mix it up, Colson. Doesn't do the same crap all the time. And so that was part of it. Paying tribute to Harriet Jacobs, who wrote that slave narrative I mentioned before, was important. She writes about how when a slave girl becomes a slave woman, she enters into a new, more terrible stage of slavery because now you're supposed to have babies. More babies means more slaves, more property, more people pick more cotton and more profits. And it seemed like that was an interesting challenge to depict, just the particular female hell of slavery versus the male slaves' hell. So it was a choice just to mix it up, and then I also hadn't done a mother-daughter relationship before, and so that seemed worthy of pursuing. So I'm always, there are choices I make because I haven't done them before, and then choices that fit the work.
Yeah, that this one just felt like both. I mean, the relationship between her search for a mother is such a kind of fundamental through line of it, but it also didn't feel like a version of this story that I'd read anywhere before. It was, so many of the stories in this area are from a male perspective, I think, and that seemed like a very deliberate choice beyond just stretching yourself, I guess.
I'm always trying to mix it up, and I think you make these choices early on, and then you have to follow through. And so, what if the Underground Railroad was a real railroad? Then you have to actually do research and figure out how to get a story out of that. And if the protagonist is female, how does that change all the different interactions? And, in all likelihood, she would have been abused. And so that is her psychology. And how does that play out in all her other relationships in the book? Can she get close to people? How do you recover from trauma? And how can I dramatize that? And so just that, all those simple decisions, I make very early on, you have to solve all those different problems and have them be realistic in the book.
And the cross-generational question, how does her experience differ from her mother's? How does her understanding of what's happening to her come through a prism of her kind of notion of what her mother's done?
Her mother has run off when she's 11, and so of course that provides a very contradictory lesson. On the one hand, you can escape and to the north and have a new life, and on the other hand, she's been abandoned to the plantation hell to fend for herself, and so that determines her psychology. There's this example of freedom, but also the counterexample of what a mother is and what it does to you when you're abandoned.
Mm. Now, I've set this up backstage, but would you mind reading the passage for us?
Sure. So Cora goes from state to state, and at one point she ends up in, I guess, a section that was in my notes for many years, Black Utopia, ? And it's a sort of a commune, a farm in Indiana run by a free black man and his wife. And they take in, the farm is a sort of little community close to the white community, and runaways go there, people wanting a fresh start, move from the south there. And they have their own sort of little nice utopian community, and they have artists come and poets, And every Saturday, they debate the big questions about what's next for the black race. So there's a man named Mingo, and he's a more conservative voice, and a man named Lander, who's a sort of progressive visionary. And during one of their debates, Lander steps up. Different pagination than the American version. Okay.
Also, they changed the ending for the Australian version.
I was going to make a joke about that, but anything she lives or dies, you know that the opposite is true.
Terrible spoiler. That's true. All your jokes are back in the Australian version.
Brother Mingo made some good points, Lander said. We can't save everyone, but that doesn't mean we can't try. Sometimes a useful delusion is better than a useless truth. Here's one delusion, that we can escape slavery. We can't. Its scars will never fade. When you saw your mother sold off, your father beaten, your sister abused by some boss or master, did you ever think that you'd sit here today without chains, without the yoke, among a new family? Everything you ever knew told you that freedom was a trick, yet here you are. Still we run, tracking by the good full moon to sanctuary. Valentine Farm, this place, is a delusion. Who told you the Negro deserved a place of refuge? Who told you that you had that right? Every minute of your life's suffering has argued otherwise. By every fact of history, it can exist. This place must be a delusion too. Yet here we are. And America, too, is a delusion, the grandest one of all. The white race believes with all its heart, that it is their right to take the land, to kill Indians, make war, enslave their brothers. This nation shouldn't exist if there's any justice in the world, for its foundations are murder, theft, and cruelty. Yet here we are. I'm supposed to answer Mingo's call for gradual progress, for closing our doors to those in need. I'm supposed to answer those who think this place is too close to the grievous influence of slavery and that we should move west. I don't have an answer for you. I don't know what we should do. The word we. In some ways, the only thing we have in common is the color of our skin. Our ancestors came from all over the African continent. It's quite large. Brother Valentine has the maps of the world in his splendid library. You can look for yourself. They had different ways of subsistence, different customs, spoke 100 different languages. And that great mixture was brought to America in the holds of slave ships to the north, to the south. Their sons and daughters picked tobacco, cultivated cotton, worked on the largest estates and the smallest farms. We are craftsmen and midwives and preachers and peddlers. Black hands built the White House, the seat of our nation's government. The word we. We are not one people, but many different people. How can one person speak for this great, beautiful race, which is not one race, but many, with a million desires and hopes and wishes for ourselves and our children? For we are Africans in America, something new in the history of the world, without models for what we will become. Color must suffice. It's brought us here to this night, this discussion, and it'll take us into the future. All I truly know is that we rise and fall as one colored family living next door to one white family. We may not know our way through the forest, but we can pick each other up when we fall, and we will arrive together.
Even though it had a longish gestation period as an idea, the book feels very timely. To what extent is that some of the ideas in that passage about blackness, about the African-American experience, did the book suddenly feel urgent in a way that maybe it hadn't earlier?
I sort of have different responses to that, because when it came out in August, I kept being asked, did Black Lives Matter? Like, was that in your thinking? And for me, it's no. I mean, I think we have these periodic moments in America where we talk about police brutality, and then we stop talking about it. you know, my whole life, there's been, you know, every 3 years, there's like a big police brutality case, and suddenly we're talking about white law enforcement's attitude towards black people, and then we stop talking about it, and then we pick up again. So for me, that's a cycle of how we live, and so I wasn't thinking about it because that's, you know, take it for granted. So I would say that until the election, and then after the election, people say, so how's your book changed now that Donald Trump's in the White House? And, you know, I talked about it before, all the sort of white nationalist, imperialist ideas that have driven American history for so long are suddenly back into play because we're being controlled by someone who believes in those things. And so I wasn't thinking about contemporary events, and definitely Donald Trump was still in his reality TV mode joke place when I was writing the book, you know, in 2015. But definitely my response to the book changed. I think I wanted to write a nice crime novel after this book, take it easy. And then I was like, I guess I have to write about institutional racism again, because I feel like I have to do something to address what's happened. And so that's my response to the book.
You wrote a very funny piece for the opinion pages of the New York Times back in 2009, I think, where you offered yourself up as a potential Secretary of Post-Racial Affairs for President Obama.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm not sure how much trickled over here, but there was talk about suddenly we have a black president and we're post-racial, which is obviously very stupid. And so that's what the piece was about. And then now it's even, you know... And now I wish I could joke about post-raciality. It seems like a nice delusion we had there for a couple of years.
Have you seen Get Out?
I have seen Get Out, yeah.
One of my favorite lines in that is Bradley Whitford constantly wanting to say, I would have voted for Obama for a third term.
Yeah.
That's the height of progressivism, which is a funny concept. So are you serious that you might, going into the next book, feel obliged to keep explicitly talking about this stuff? Do you feel a pressure as a writer to be an activist in your work?
No, I mean, it's all how I'm feeling about things. I mean, yeah. I think I do get asked, like, do you have a responsibility? And I have a responsibility to be a good husband and a good father. That's about it. And then I do things for, you know, I pick things according to how I'm feeling and what I feel I have to do. So it's all, I don't really feel beholden to whatever role people are or aren't imagining for me. I can't imagine a lot of people are like, what's Colson Whitehead's role? And how is he doing it?
But you're an elder statesman now. You've won these big prizes. This is the kind of pinnacle of acclaim. Does that mean that suddenly you're the go-to spokesman for this stuff?
Well, I think if you are an available black person, suddenly you're supposed to be like talking on people's douchebag talk shows. There are plenty of other people to do that instead of me. I don't like leaving the house. You leave the house, there are people outside and stuff. So I'll just write, and that's my way of communicating my ideas.
You know, there's a smattering of applause for how much you didn't want to leave the house then. There's someone over there who's been brought tonight by a friend.
Yes, shut-ins unite, you know, yeah.
There are people out there, it's the worst. How surreal is it, though? Because even the publication of this book was accelerated because of the Oprah thing. Like, that must be a very strange machine to be part of.
It is. I mean, you know, they wanted to be surprised. And so last April, you know, we got the phone call. And then not supposed to tell anybody. So, you know, people were like, are you worried about, you know, publication? And I was like, not really. You know, I feel pretty good about the book. And what Oprah means that people pick it up. It doesn't mean they'll get good reviews, but it means that more people who would normally pick up one of my books and think, oh, that sounds dumb, and keep walking, will pick it up. So I knew we'd sell a few copies.
A strange machine, but unlike Jonathan Franzen, you weren't ambivalent about that acclaim?
Well, you know, Franzen did take the...
eventually.
Yeah. So, no, it's great. I mean, you know, Oprah has been such a huge figure. She's been the queen of black America since the 1980s, and so and I had stopped thinking that she might pick one of my books because they're kind of weird. And so I was very shocked and yeah, very delighted.
But, I mean, she epitomized a funny thing that happens with your books, which is hearing her talk about it, it was a thing of discovery. This new guy, Colson Whitehead, who's written nothing before this.
Yes, that was true. And I didn't correct her when she was like, you never talk about race. I was like, you know, you don't correct Oprah, Alexa, pretty much, when you're on her show.
So look under your chair. My backlist is there. I'll read them.
Yeah. So that was cool. And then, you know, I think, obviously, I've just been in a really good mood last year. You know, I try to be in a bad mood because that's my default mode, and it's more difficult. But obviously, the reception has been really great, so...
Oh, it's a nice thing. In a few minutes, you'll get a chance to ask questions of Colson as well. And if they're entirely questions about zombies or entirely questions about growing up in the 80s, you'll be revealing where your fandom lies. But it's a broad church, so everyone welcome with whatever version of it. So just coming back again to that kind of weight of pressure of history on the writing of this book, I read an interview with you where you said you couldn't bring yourself to watch 12 Years a Slave, that there was something about the cinematic depiction of it that was almost unbearable to have to face.
Yeah, I mean, people ask, like, was it hard to deal with the subject every day? And I think the hard part was doing the research and realizing, again, like what my nameless ancestors went through. When I wrote the first section, the prologue with Ajari, Cora's grandmother, the narrative voice, I guess, was an effective tool for keeping me at a distance. And then, so 100 pages into writing, I was like, oh, I can watch 12 Years a Slave now. I'm putting it off, but I'm not getting affected by his vision. I might even, like, get some slang words or something I can steal. And I got an hour in, and I couldn't watch it. You know, I could put these brutalities on the page every day, but even seeing actors go through it, seeing children go through what I was describing was too much. And so I haven't finished the movie. I had taped the remake of Roots to show like my kid, like the same way my parents showed me. I'm not going to watch it anytime soon. So it's strange. I mean, I could write it, but I couldn't watch it.
How do your characters, not just in this book, but in all your books, how do they live for you? Like, do you feel a certain sense of protectiveness over them? Or do you think about them as kind of as living beings who you're guiding through the book?
I didn't used to, and then starting with Sag Harbor, which is autobiographical, so maybe that would start it. I've had much more affection for them over the years, and I think maybe it's just growing as a person and being more empathetic. And I felt the most with Cora. I wouldn't revisit the character. But I have gone back to the last 30 pages, and I feel like, as a writer, I feel like they're my best 30 pages that I've done. You know, I've been in 8 books, I've been sort of leading up to the end of this book. And then I think the way she turned out, I'm very proud of, and I feel very connected to. And so, I hope it's not a trend, so I don't really like hanging out with them that much longer after I finish the book. But that has been what's been sort of happening lately, and definitely more with Cora than other characters.
Does that make the prospect of adaptation a frightening one?
It feels very separate. You know, most adaptations are bad, so if you accept that and it's halfway good, then you know, you've won. So,
I think John le Carré said that a book is a cow and a adaptation is like an OXO cube, a stock cube.
Sure.
And
sure, yeah.
If it's beef flavored, they've done a decent job. And that's
sure,
the most you can hope
sounds
for.
Sounds good.
But it's being adapted for TV rather than for cinema. It's Barry Jenkins who made Moonlight. I mean, that's a pretty good pedigree.
Going well, it was wild because we sent it out to film people when it first came out. And he was the first person, not the first person, but he had a whole plan together. And Moonlight hadn't come out yet. And so he hadn't even... I didn't know who he was, and I saw it like on my computer, on a little, you know, tiny screen. But he was really smart, and I had to interview him. Like, what do I know about interviewing filmmakers? But I was like, are there any other movies about slavery that would inspire you? It was like, slavery movies? No. I was thinking of P.T. Anderson as The Master and There Will Be Blood. And I was like, all right, you got the job. Sounds good.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's going to be 6 to 8 episodes. And, you know, there's so much happens in the book, it couldn't really be a movie, so it makes sense to have a longer time to deal with
it. There's also a really strong kind of, the nature of the slavery narrative is escape gives itself a kind of narrative forward propulsion that clearly is fun to write.
Yeah, I mean, I have had books with no plot, like Sag Harbor, and books with a strong plot. And, you know, they take different ways of thinking about telling the story. And, yeah, I mean, a slave's journey north is a life or death transaction. If she's caught, she could be killed. And so that suspense structure is built into the story. Mm.
And we almost told them how it ended before.
I know.
Lucky we stopped, pulled up short. Although not in the Australian edition, quite different. Now, if you have a question for Colson, please put your hand up and wave it around and one of the ushers will make their way to you. So don't be shy. There are some over here, so we will start over this side.
So you said that we only pay attention to racial issues in the U.S. in brief a few years at a time, and then we lose track of it.
Police brutality specifically, but in general, that's also true. So,
do you think that there are other topics that we can be addressing while our attention wanders from that that would help with it? Like, we're clearly post-racial now, but what can be on the reading list of the next president that might help move that along?
The one after Trump? Because Trump doesn't read.
I don't have much hope for Trump as a reader.
Yeah. You know, I'm not sure. I don't think about things in that way. But I'll always recommend Lonesome Dove and The Odyssey. You know, yeah, it's, I don't think of things that way, but I think a good grounding in the canon of Western culture, does it help? I don't know.
Any reader at all would be, be a start. There is a beautiful passage in the Underground Railroad about when Cora's opening the almanac for the first time that absolutely epitomizes that value of being a reader and what a book does and the way in which the worlds it opens up to.
Yeah, I guess it opens crisply, and she's like, it was the first time she'd ever been the first person to open a book, which we take for granted, but obviously for her, it was a big thing.
And also in that case, because it's an almanac for the next year, it's a thing from the future. It's a really lovely image.
I'm just curious about your choices you made in terms of the depiction of the horrors of slavery, the violence in the book. And I think you mentioned before you referred to it as depicting it in a matter-of-fact way. I was wondering why you chose that. You could have gone into excruciating detail.
Yeah, it's interesting because the last novel I wrote, Zone One, you know, the violence is dramatized and it is very much in the horror tradition. And I borrowed that matter-of-fact language from slave narratives. And they will describe the most horrible thing devoid of emotion, because if that is your everyday experience, you don't have to adorn it in colorful language, just tell it like it is. And so I borrowed it from that language from there. And then Garcia Marquez, in describing his version of magic realism, talks about how he got it from his grandmother, and she would tell stories about town and life in the town, and weave in fantastic things like, and then the sheriff took off on his magnificent wings, we never saw him again, and tell it with a straight face, a brick face is what he says. And so that use of merging the fantastic and realistic worked, I think. And then also, that is just how, if you read slave narratives, it's how they would describe, you know, the most horrible thing.
I do like any question that begins with, I want to ask you about your choices. I was hoping it was going to be life choices.
Yes, exactly.
Curious. The other book that I thought of a bit, particularly in the skyscraper scene, was Cloud Atlas, and the way in which that opened up possibility. One of the things reading this book is any knowledge of the history meant that you had this kind of fatalism and pessimism. But interspersing that with the fantastic meant that as a reader, anything seems suddenly possible.
Sure. Yeah, it's funny because for years I would describe the book to friends and say, and then she goes to different states that are really alternative histories and be like, huh? And then I started saying Gulliver's Travel and people are like, oh, I get it. And Cloud Atlas is the one example, which I love, example I've used of what I was trying to get away from, reeling in the fantastic instead of giving into the great pleasures of jumping around in time. And so the early structure did jump around in that sort of way, and part of, I think, finding the voice was reeling it in to a more controlled use of fantasy. Like, I guess I describe it using Spinal Tap instead of having the fantasy up to 11, you know, cranking it down to like a mellow 1 and seeing how it works.
Having fantasy in there at all, though, is liberating. Like, it, even if you're going to be restrained in your use of it, as a reader, it means that you're completely unmoored by the, well, this has to end this way. We know it's going to end this way because this is what happened. Suddenly, that's no longer a thing, and it's...
No, I mean, in terms of suspense and not sticking to what actually happened, I can make things much more horrible for Cora and her friends, which is bad for them, but good for storytelling.
But then the unicorns come in the last section, and it's quite surprising.
Hi, Colson. The other day I mentioned to a bookseller at readings that I was only reading people of colour this year, which is really exciting to me because I spent the last few years reading only old white men. And he said, I'm really afraid that you're missing out. and when I read you, I don't feel like I'm missing out. So my question is, do you have any feelings about breaking the canon or rewriting the canon or even just writing into the canon?
Well, yeah, good question. I think they're two different things. I think, you know, sometimes when I start a project, I want to see how other people do it, and sometimes I don't, depending on what kind of anxieties I have. And so when it rests... Before I started writing, I was like, I'm going to reread Beloved, I haven't read in 30 years. I'm going to reread The Known World by Edward Jones, and just see how people I admire have dealt with slavery. And I got 30 pages into Beloved, and I was like, I'm totally fucked. Toni Morrison is like the master. You can't really enter into that kind of canon. And so when I was starting to write, and I was feeling cowed and scared, like, why do I have the right to write a novel? I accepted that people, more no matter what you're writing about, whether it's slavery or war or relationships, someone more talented and smarter than you has done it before. So all I can do is I hope that I have something to bring, and I can do with my own, bring my own individualness to the table, and hope that I do it in the way that other people come along. And so that has spared me a lot of like anxiety over. People have come before me. And then, you know, I've always been very self-conscious. So I didn't want to do any kind of cliched book. You know, when I started out, I didn't want to do the first, that autobiographical first novel where you get back at everyone who wronged you. I saved that for Sag Harbor, my fourth novel. So I never wanted to really, I've always had a weird angle on things. And so The Intuitionist is about race and the city, but it's using elevator inspectors. And that seemed like a weird way in to talk about race and history. So I'm always coming from just my weird sort of off-kilter point of view, and that seems to get rid of a lot of those sort of anxieties or worries. So thanks.
And well done for doing the old white men as well, because they are neglected. So thank God.
Yeah, no one pushes the old white man on you. So
yeah, no.
Yeah, so.
Thank God someone's thinking about them. Now, looking for the next question, just here.
Thank I'm you. Down here. Yeah, I just read The Underground Railroad over Christmas, and it was absolutely fantastic, and I'm sure it'll be one of those books on the bookshelves that I look back to and think, wow, how did someone do that? So I wanted to ask what general philosophies guide your writing, and you were kind of answering it then, but I'd like you to expand that a little bit, please.
Sure, no, yeah, thanks. Thanks for reading. I'm glad you liked it. Well, general philosophies, I mean, mixing it up. If I can do something, why do it again? You know, if I had figured out a certain way of storytelling or a certain kind of character, I don't want to do it. With my first book, which has a female protagonist, I'd written a novel before that everyone hated, and that was my learning to write. And it just seemed, my next outing, maybe I'll do something with a plot. People like a plot. Instead of having a first-person New York hipster as a protagonist, I want to have a third-person narrator and have a female protagonist, and maybe it won't get bought and people won't get it, but I'll have grown as a writer by presenting a challenge. And so writing my zombie book, what do I like from the horror and science fiction movies I watched and read when I was a kid that inspired me to become a writer. I became a writer because of Marvel Comics and Stephen King and The Twilight Zone. What can I throw out from that tradition? How can I have my own spin on the post-apocalypse? So there's very long passages about the city and consumerism and a new kind of zombie that pops up in the book that becomes a way of talking about nostalgia. And so, just trying not to bore myself by writing in the same mode from book to book, and then whatever two people follow me from book to book, surprising them, you know.
I think it was an essay you wrote where you talked about being a Stephen King fan and the fact that early on as a writer, the way you articulated what you wanted to do was be the black Stephen King. So you want to do the black, the stand.
Sounds like,
the black, yeah. You take each book and then want to kind of...
Just put the black in front of it.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. So,
not the worst plan in the world.
If we're talking slave narratives with a female protagonist and the end fantasy, then Octavia Butler's Kindred is clearly sort of in that world. Is that something that you engaged with directly or indirectly? And can you talk a bit about how you see the relationship between that and the railroad?
Yeah, I mean, I did read it like about 2 years before, but I wasn't really thinking about it. And to me, novel and slave narratives are two different things. A slave narrative is a biographical memoir, historical, and Kindred, just, crazy old novel, playing with history, the stuff I do. So it seems very separate. So while I definitely like Octavia Butler, I wasn't thinking of it. Maybe it's leaked in there somewhere. And maybe you could point out where I owe her a debt or something. but she's great, and that book is great. So I think of her up, sir.
Yeah.
Microphone's coming.
Okay. Were you writing when the police atrocities came, and did they affect your writing? And did you go back and rewrite it differently, or what? Did it affect your writing, or did you have an idea right from the start what where you were going to get to?
Right. I mean, I think our last big conversation about police brutality, Ferguson, Black Lives Matter, it was going on, but I wasn't thinking about it. Sort of folded into my experience as a black American. But there are parallels between what happens in the book and now, and they didn't really need to be forced. If, in reading some of the slave narratives, they were described being stopped by a slave patroller. A slave patroller is a policeman before there were police, and they could stop any black person and demand to see their papers. So if you're a free person, you always had to have your ID. And if you're a slave on an errand, you had to have your pass to get off the plantation. And the language that the slaves or free people would use to describe being stopped by a slave patroller is the same language I have used to describe being stopped by the police. And so the slave patroller policies are echoed in stop and frisk policies in the States now, or just being stopped anywhere, driving while black, walking while black in the wrong neighborhood. And so they weren't in the forefront of my mind, but the language as a modern entity I would use to describe being stopped and harassed or handcuffed by the police is the same language. I found the same phrases in 150 years ago from slaves and free people. And so there's just the continuity of oppression and humiliation that I don't have to necessarily, didn't have to be forced to put in there, because it was just sort of there in the material and there in the world now. So.
Did that have an impact on writing about some of the passages about lynchings, for example? Incredibly brutal, and it's that awful thing where you go back to the historical record and it's worse than you could imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I would put something in the book and think, is that too over the top? And then I could just go back to my research and like, no. I'm a writer writing in 2015, and I'm thinking up stuff. I haven't devoted decades to thinking up brutal tortures to keep my slaves in line, and my pappy didn't teach me how he kept slaves in line. And so there there are generations of sadists who thought up really evil shit to keep slaves in line, and nothing I could come up with could compete with what they had devised for black people.
Hi, I was just interested to know, are your characters fully formed and do you have a complete sort of sense of who they are before you start writing the story, or do you finally discover more about them and they change in ways perhaps that you perhaps didn't expect when you first started?
Sure, I have vague ideas of, I know what they have to do plot-wise, so they do a lot of outlining, but I know vaguely who they are, and then they really, I'm trying to avoid saying come alive, but I can't do it. They start coming alive once they get on the page. And so for me, I knew what Cora had to do because I had a plot, and I knew I had different situations she was going to be in, but I didn't know how she walked and talked. And for me, the two defining moments for her, and I'm always trying to find a way in, were when she stands up to the bully who's trying to take her garden. That's one. And the second one is when she protects Chester from being beaten. And so she's seen people being beaten before and never stood up, and why should she do it this time? And it seemed that kind of courage could inform a character who can take that imaginative leap to run north. And so finding the sort of way in to a character when they first appear is really is important for me. Ridgway, the slave master, I didn't know who he was for a long time. And, I'm in New York, I like writing about New York, and I was sort of sad with this book, I couldn't put any jokes in. I couldn't get New York in there, it takes place in the South. And then halfway through the book, I read Eric Foner, historian's book on the Underground Railroad, and it talks about the war between abolitionists and slave masters in the New York courts, all these different sort of legal strategies, and they were always one-upping each other. And then it seemed, I can put Ridgway in New York for two pages. I can get New York in there. I know who he is. And so I usually start with what they have to do because I think of the plot first. And then I try to find these triggering moments or little moments of purchase into who they are.
Is it hard writing someone like Ridgway?
No, it's fun. I just didn't know what he sounded like. I want a formidable villain to stand up to Cora, who's formidable. I want him to be a sort of evil philosopher rhapsodizing about imperialism and manifest destiny and white nationalism. And so just finding that his voice took a while, but it always comes. I mean, at this point, I sort of know it'll come eventually. And with, the magic of Microsoft Word, I can just say Ridgway intro TK and then come back 6 months later and put him in there.
For writing proper evil and villainy, were you tempted to try and find ways to humanize him or to, give him a little kind of sympathetic thing here or there just to...
I don't think sympathetic, but I think he is human, hopefully. And I think, seeing him with his father and then with Homer, like, what is he? What's that Homer thing? So so not sympathetic, but definitely, I think, human, I think.
You're not like a puppy or something.
Yeah.
halfway there.
Look, this may sound naive or innocent, but looked at from afar, it seems that there's a new renaissance of black writing, filmmaking, television. Do you think there is? And if so, why do you think it's come about?
I think, I think there isn't a reason. I think, I think in terms of film, you can make, there are more opportunities, there are cheap ways of making movies and TV shows now, and so there are more opportunities for African-American artists to get their work out there. I think there's more of a conversation about diversity, and so people just are overcoming, white producers, studios are overcoming their biases that they didn't know they had, and giving more opportunities. Publishing is more open to it. I think there are institutional racist failures in publishing, and Chimamanda sells some copies. There's our new sort of African boom, and so, and then of course they'll probably forget about it 3 years from now. So. I've always known a lot of African-American writers and filmmakers, and I feel like we've always had the same numbers. I think, mostly in terms of film and TV, there's more opportunities, but I think there's always been, I've always known a lot of novelists who are getting out there. So.
Would you speak a little bit about the boy that accompanies Ridgway? What was the inspiration for that? What's going on there?
Exactly. Old Coulson would have had like a 10-page Homer biography. New Coulson was Homer's gonna Homer. And I think the idea between Homer and Ridgway is that there are all sorts of strange corners of the master-slave relationship. There were slaves who, after the Civil War, stayed in their plantations and worked with their masters. They knew nothing else, and so they stayed, and that's crazy. There were slave masters who were incredibly sadistic who would swear that they loved Bessie. Oh, Bessie raised me. She's like a mother to me. While they, you know, beat Bessie's daughter and stuff like that. And so it's a complex relationship, and I think I wanted to keep Ridgway and Homer strange and elusive. And then
Black Stephen King would have devoted 600 pages
exactly,
to explaining
yes.
the relationship.
I wanted to ask you a question about, this goes back to your introduction, Michael, about Native American literature and the relationship between the, I mean, this previous question around the boom or the renaissance in Black literature in the United States and the seeming void of Native American literature, and whether there is any relationship or conversation between those communities, between your community and the Native American community. You reference the suffering of the Native American community in your book. And I wanted to ask you that question. However, what I do want to close with, given it's the last question, is more a prospective, futuristic observation by you. Ta-Nehisi Coates, I mean, as a contemporary of yours, where do you position yourself in the spectrum next to him? He's a father, a black father. He has an acutely bleak perspective on the American dream. You have some really beautiful observations in your book about American imperialism and what that's done to minority communities. How do you position it? Do you see things as bleakly as he does for the future?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to be bleak. American history is bleak. I think I have children, so I have to hope that things will get better, and I think things do get better by degrees. Obviously, I had it better than my grandparents and my parents, and I hope my kids have it better than me. But it really is such a incremental progress. What I liked about Ta-Nehisi Coates' book is that really he was just describing what it was like to live in America as a black man, being born between 1960 and 1975. It seemed like he really just captured all the sort of cultural moments and political moments. That's definitely part of my experience and our sort of Gen X-y kind of experience. So it's not me. I feel what he's doing is very different. And I don't really... It's not for me to situate myself with him. I just see him as a fellow traveler. And then other people who are wiser and read both and can probably have some distance can see where our work overlaps or doesn't.
So you're not going to fight him? No, that's disappointing. I thought there was going to be a throwdown just at the end there. Yeah. So. Look, we've been very lucky to hear from Coulson this evening. I have no doubt that the Underground Railroad will sit alongside Beloved and the Known World for generations to come. It's an extraordinary book, and I, for one, can't wait to see what new Coulson does next. Please join me in thanking Coulson. Michael.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Center podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercenter.com for the best in books, writing, and ideas from Melbourne, Australia, and the world.